More tech layoffs indicate a couple of disturbing trends. The doomsayers might be right in that AI is going to be taking your job. We're going to look at this possibility along with other tech news of the week in this episode of Today in Tech. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Today in Tech. I'm Keith Shaw. The guy behind the glowing monitors is Chris. Hello, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. And joining me again as guest co-host is Brandon Maney. He is the co-founder of the Mangrove Collective and CTO at Glasshouse. Hello, Brandon from the West Coast.
Hello, Keith. Hello,
Chris. I feel like you're our West Coast correspondent now. Your thumb is on the heartbeat of Silicon Valley culture, which is great because we need that from the East Coast here.
Big shoes to fill, but I'll do my best.
We were off for a week, so because Brandon had a vacation time, and so he looks tanned, rested, and ready to go here, right?
Yes, cannot wait.
All right. So the big news of last week and this week was we saw another wave of layoffs in the technology and automotive space. Tesla, Rivian, Google, Take-Two Interactive, and Best Buy were among the companies that have eliminated a significant number of their employees. But the reasons that are given are different, so we're going to group them into two different reasons. So first off, let's start with the big one. Tesla has laid off more than 10% of its workforce, or plans to at some point, and they've lost a lot of their top executives. This came because a few weeks after it reported its first year-over-year decline in vehicle delivery since 2020, Tesla is now planning to lay off over 10% of its global workforce, according to an internal company wide email. That works out to about 14,000 of the 140,473 employees that Tesla reported in its latest annual earnings. And at the moment, it's not clear which teams at Tesla will be impacted. If you go to that layoffs FYI site and you look at the numbers of employees that were being released, like the 14,000 is now the biggest one of the last since the pandemic, I think. Yeah. So it is the biggest single company layoff if they get to all 14,000 people. Elon Musk actually did confirm that the layoffs would happen. There's an interesting quote in this story where he says that Musk said about every 5 years we need to reorganize and streamline the company for the next phase of growth. That could just be corporate speak, because it could be corporate speak. It's like, yeah, we're not laying off because electric vehicle demand has gone down. Making it almost feel like it's a normal part of the company's lifespan is that every 5 years you have to go through the layoffs.
I find that very awkward, because I feel like you should be aiming to do the opposite, wouldn't you?
You should be hiring every 5 years.
Grow your footprint,
reach
your
tier, yeah.
Yeah, grow your product, which, you know, they very well may be growing their product, yes. But when he says about every 5 years we need to reorganize, streamline the company for the next phase of growth, I don't know. I just feel like what he might be trying to say in disguise is we need to reorganize and streamline the company to fit in the current economic climate.
Could be.
Maybe, because I just find that hard to believe. After every 5 years, we need a chop. And it's like, well, why would you want to work there if every 5 years you're going to...
Yeah, I mean, that company culture would just be like, oh, wow, I got to be on my toes. And wouldn't that be a subtle dig at your hiring practices? Like if you can't find people to grow the company, it's almost like if you're growing a plant, every 5 years you have to like trim the...
Yeah, it's like I don't want to
prune the plant or trim the fat.
I don't want to work at a company for just 5 years. I mean, maybe there are people that are that do want to do that, but it's like I want to really, you know, maximize potential there. And it's like, oh, about every 5 years, I just find it weird. Yeah. But hey, he's Elon Musk. Maybe he knows something we don't. I don't know. Maybe there's some sort of secret algorithm to this hiring process thing he knows, or I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I thought the interesting part, it felt like this was some like Twitter hiring or more on the software side that was leaking into the physical world and into the automotive. Huh. Every 5 years, turnover, the restructuring, given how fast things move in software, those are some cycles that we are definitely used to and we've been conditioned to work within. But seeing it happen in automotive and more physical goods and more hardware side, I think that's very different.
I just think the big reason obviously is because demand has gone down for electric vehicles over the last couple of years.
It could be that, yeah. And maybe it's just because there's more competition out there now on the market. I mean, Rivian does really well. I mean, everywhere you look, there's a Rivian.
Except for the fact that Rivian is also going to cut 1% of its workforce. Right.
So maybe it is. Maybe it is just there's not that much of a demand that they thought that there would be. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and Tesla also had issues with its Cybertruck. You saw a couple of those articles where deliveries were delayed, and then there were some rumors that the gas pedal, was it the accelerator? Something was falling off of the accelerator, the thing you push.
Oh, yeah.
That's such a technical term. So there were rumors of that, and so that's slowing deliveries, and that can't be good news. But yeah, so at least those two groups of layoffs, the Tesla ones and the Rivian ones, were because of lower demand. And so, but then the other two that I want to talk about, Google is the first one. They're basically restructuring their finance team as part of an AI shift, the CFO told employees in a memo. Alphabet Chief Financial Officer Ruth Porat said in a memo Wednesday, or this last week, that Google is restructuring its finance organization, a move that will include layoffs and relocations as the company pushes resources to favor investments in artificial intelligence. Now, if you're saying the loud part out loud, wait, the truth out loud, what's that phrase?
Quiet part out loud.
Yes, you're saying the quiet part out loud. It's like we're putting so much money into AI that we can't afford some of the finance employees. So bye.
Tell
me if this quote makes it sound like okay, so here's the quote. The tech sector is in the midst of a tremendous platform shift with AI. As a company, this means we have the opportunity to make more helpful products for billions of users and provide faster solutions to our customers, but it also means we collectively have to make tough decisions, including how and where we work, to align with our highest priority areas. So I think it's because they're putting so much money into building AI products that they can't, so they have to cut back somewhere. And so they chose to, cut within the finance.
Well, they're
accountants. Is that like really going to move the needle? That's
like you said, the finuglers.
I mean,
really?
They're putting so much money behind AI that they're going to have, I mean, when they do cut jobs, the AI that they're creating is going to fill those jobs.
Well, yeah, and then this CNBC article says the latest cuts follow a broader effort by Google to rearrange its workforce and resources to accommodate further investments in new technologies such as AI as advertising growth slows. The CEO, Pichai, told employees in January that more job cuts were likely coming in 2024, though he did not specify which teams would be affected. So that's kind of an indication that at least investing in, it's not like the AI is directly taking your job. It's not like they're saying, we're getting rid of you because AI can do your job better. But investing in AI,
yes,
we need the money. Mm-hmm. You're expensive, Mr. CPA accountant. You're out of here. All right.
Well, and it talks about their hub model, right? So they're moving. It talks about their hub model in that article and how they're moving to the workforces around. Like all of that accounting, all that finance stuff still needs to get done. The way I read it is that they're moving to offshore or other lower costs.
I think subtly they'll probably institute probably some AI tools that might speed up some of those processes and maybe automate internally and maybe use the excuse of the layoff at least to subtly indicate that they're going to be doing more AI internally for those processes or whatever those people were doing.
Yeah, I know people say out there that AI isn't going to replace your job, but I feel like it's going to slowly trickle in, and
you're going
to start to notice something.
And they'll just try to word it so that it sounds different. Right. And it's like, well, it's not directly, we're not directly replacing you with this, but we are adding new tools, and those tools will do processes that you were doing. And,
efficiency.
Yeah, the smart companies or the smart employees will learn how to use these tools to make themselves more useful and better. Maybe. And, I don't know. It all depends on, I guess, the company and how smart they are with handling all this. But here's the other evidence. So there were there was a story this week about Best Buy getting rid of a lot of its Geek Squad employees. And so initially I was going to talk about the value of the Geek Squad at Best Buy. But now there was another story that came out today basically announcing that they plan on launching an AI-powered customer support service a week after conducting mass layoffs of Geek Squad employees. Okay, so Best Buy is developing the project using Google's Gemini AI models. That's a horrible idea. With the goal of launching the AI-powered self-service customer support option in late summer. According to the retailer, the tool promises to, quote, greatly improve the experience for Best Buy customers. You know what's a great experience for Best Buy customers? Actually talking to someone at Best Buy. Or actually yes. talking to an employee who can help you yeah. or fix things for you.
I just want to say I'm such a huge fan of the Greek Squad or the Geek Squad okay. and what they provide.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, from my time in engineering and software, I've worked with a ton of really talented IT professionals. A number of them have come up through the Geek Squad. It's a great way for people to who are, you know, can get hands-on technology, to learn to interact with the public, to make some money, to launch into other technical careers. So I'm a huge fan of what it sort of provides as a launching stone into a career. I was really sad to see that this was happening and the direction that Best Buy was taking.
Yeah. Now, the story does further say that, you know, they are saying that it doesn't suggest a complete overlap between the two. It notes the AI agent will be accessible via BestBuy.com, the old mobile app, and over the phone. Geek Squad employees often focus on in-home installs of appliances or repairs of electronics, although they can take customer support calls. So technically, they're not.
They should do more than that.
Like, it's just bad timing, I think, on the side of Best Buy.
Home installs and stuff like that. Nah, we should be able to bring, like, if we have an actual like technical error with a computer, we should be able to bring it in. I don't know. I just find that.
Well, so from my perspective, I never understood the Geek Squad from my own technical knowledge. But again, yeah. I've been a technology guy. I've installed my own home network. I've done all of this stuff. But I know that I'm an outlier in that world. You know, the Geek Squad is more for the people. I don't want to say my grandmother or grandmother.
I think so.
You know, it's the general consumer who's like, I don't want to touch any of this stuff. I don't want to learn any of this stuff. Just install it. Make sure I know how it works. And then if something goes wrong, you can fix it. And that's what the Geek Squad always was from a consumer standpoint. And so, if those people are gone, like how, you know, AI is not going to tell my mother-in-law how to basically reboot her router.
No,
you're going to get that call, Keith.
Yes, I'm the home IT guy. Right. So I get the call. And for the most part, what my mother-in-law has done is instead of trying to fix it or call me, she just willingly accepts having either a broken iPad or something like that. And it's not until it gets really bad that we go down and go to her house and fix everything for her.
Yep. So I mean, deep down, I'm actually surprised that Geek Squad still exists.
Still,
because YouTube.
Okay.
If you have a question or a problem.
But what if you can't get connected to the internet?
Well, then that's when we go.
I guess that's when
you. That's when we call you. Okay. But I mean, because of YouTube and the internet.
Well, you also have this thing too. You have a phone.
Right. Yeah. You can use a mobile network and whatnot, but whatever. But it's so easy for anybody to just, you can learn how to build your own computer. On YouTube, you can troubleshoot a lot of things from influencers influencers on YouTube. But I think if you're a casual citizen, human being, or something like that, or you know someone who's a little bit older who isn't familiar with how the internet works, Geek Squad is probably your best bet.
You know what my favorite YouTube how-to thing is?
What's that?
And you're gonna laugh at me.
Probably.
Okay, so it's all about auto repair and auto maintenance for me. So I took my car to get I took it to a friend of ours who's a mechanic, and he says to me, he goes, I couldn't replace the air filter on your car because we just couldn't get, like, they didn't have the stock in part. But they didn't have the part in stock. So they did everything else. And so I was like, I'll just go to AutoZone or one of those car, I'll just pick one up there because it was on the way home. Okay. Why are you shaking your head, Chris? I shouldn't go to AutoZone?
Well, sometimes they don't care OEM parts. So you just want to try to get that,
Well, for an air filter, I'm pretty sure that.
Oh, okay. It was just an air filter.
It was just an air filter. Okay. However, when I opened up my trunk or opened up the top of my car, I couldn't find where the air filter was. So I go onto YouTube and go, how do I change the air filter in, the year of my car? And, instantly on YouTube, a thing will pop up and then it says, oh, okay, now I know where to, because again, this, you know, Honda's, they cover everything. And so, yeah, you know, learning how to basically unclip the thing so that I'm not breaking the car.
It was just your cabin air filter?
No, the cabin, no, that's easy. I could do that without a video.
Oh, yeah.
No, the air filter that's in the engine part.
Oh, that's easy, yeah.
Yeah, as long as, yeah, it's easy to change it once you find out where it is.
Come on, Keith. You should know this. Should be instinctual.
They're all, no, it's all covered by, like, plastic. You know, plastic. And even, I think the battery is even, plastic, you know, covered now. And so they've all, you know, because you want to protect it from moisture or rain or whatever. Like
traps in all that heat.
Anyway, and so this is not the first, you know, again, if you go to YouTube to find all that stuff, it's a lot easier than trying to, like, A, look it up on your manual, or B, take it to a shop. Obviously, you're not going to do that. So,
yeah.
Is there any angle of how-to stuff, Brandon, that you use YouTube for?
Definitely the car stuff, right? As you were going through that, I was thinking, yeah, about my windshield wiper replacements, or, you know, right, a little thing. I'll order it, it'll come to the house, and then I'll go down to the garage and try and give it a shot. That's the one that comes the most to mind right now. I guess maybe some cooking stuff too.
Ah, I was going to bring up cooking, see if you do the cooking stuff.
Yeah, those are the two big ones of, like, oh yeah, how do, like, a hard-boiled egg, how long do you do it for? Or, you know, is it 11 minutes? When's it a soft boil? Do you use ice? Like, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think AI is going to be able to completely replace that video how-to part of it. I mean, they might. I mean, I use AI to find out how long to cook something and what temperature I should cook it at so that I don't get a, you know, bacteria. But other than that, you know, I still like watching a video because, again, it's specific to my car model for the car stuff. All right. One more story of layoffs I wanted to talk about. The Take-Two Interactive is laying off about 5% of its workforce, or about 579 workers, and canceling several projects. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is the publisher of Grand Theft Auto 6. So they're associated with Rockstar Games, but they're the ones that are building the game. Is that how that works, Chris?
Publisher? Yeah. They're the publisher.
Okay. The news follows claims from CEO Strauss Zelnick that the publisher had no plans for layoffs amid its planned cost reduction program. Basically, it expects to incur between $160 and $200 million in total charges, with $120 million to $140 million related to title cancellations. So they're also eliminating some other projects that are in development. But it's weird to see the developer of, you know, something that is looking to be the world's biggest game if they get it out next year.
Yeah.
Because it's been 10 plus years since Grand Theft Auto 5 came out, and it's going to be this huge thing. So it's weird to see a company that has such high potential growth down the road. You were watching some videos around this, Chris, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little surprising. I mean, yeah, they're going to make probably a couple $1 billion off of GTA 6. It's going to be probably one of the most bought game in history. I mean, when Rockstar comes out with a game, it's finished, it's done, it's polished.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Well, again, this was 10 years. Well, so 10 years ago, that was the case. But, you know, right, since then, we've had 10 years of other companies that have screwed up.
They've had 10 years to make this game, and it's like, it's probably going to be 10 out of 10, probably, just guessing. Okay. And the other thing too that you have to take into consideration too is they're going to increase the price of this game. So it's no longer, like, I have a feeling it's going to be more than $70. It's probably going to be closer to 80, just based off of how long it took for them to make this game. But not only that, I think they have to try to adapt to, again, the current
would we have noticed this story if it came out in a week where you didn't have the Tesla and Google announcements and the other big ones?
I mean, if you try to stay up to date with the gaming industry, yeah, I mean, I think you would have noticed it. But again,
can we figure out why they would have done it then, or why they were doing this?
I mean, you're really not going to know. I mean, yeah, the only thing they published is, you know, your atypical corporate boilerplate. You know, we're trying to align ourselves to be streamlined and, you know, kind of similar to what Elon said. It's your typical corporate speech to say that, you know, our layoffs are justified because we need to, you know, it's for the company and whatnot. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't think we're ever really going to know. But if I were to take a guess, I think they're just trying to better align themselves to be able to survive in the current, you know, our current economic situation, right?
Right.
Because, you know, inflation is still there. They're still trying to, you know. The other thing, too, about Rockstar, and I don't think many people think about this, but, like, their game life, their game cycle, their game production cycle is, like, 5 to 8 years.
Yeah.
It's long.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like they'll release a game 1 year and then wait 5, 6, 7, 8 years later to make another one. It's not like they make one game and then next year they have a new one and then the year after that they make another one. So, you know, I feel like they got to make some sort of profit in between. I mean, they do have their live services, right, for their game, but still, you know, it's I don't know. If I were to come up with another, you know, reason why, just pulling something out of my hat, maybe it's just because they need to readjust their game cycle.
Or they just needed my feeling is the financial stuff. They just needed to show a better profit or a better indicator for whatever shareholders they got if they're a public company. I mean,
shareholders. Yeah, you know, could be shareholders or, you know, the CEO wants a little more in his pocket.
Yeah.
You know, double the salary or triple it, you know.
What bothers me about that is that it feels too easy now for a lot of companies to just go the layoff route.
Yeah.
And that's what's disturbing to me is that, you know, layoffs for a company always used to be kind of a last resort. And now it's starting to feel like, especially you get a comment like that from Elon Musk where, oh, that's just part of our normal 5-year cycle. Like they're trying to make it sound like, oh, well, layoffs are just an inevitable part of working. I never had to worry about a layoff at a company that I worked at until, you know, where I was 20 years into my career, except for the one time that I worked for a newspaper and they shut down the entire newspaper. So that was not like I didn't have to worry because everybody was gone at that point.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you start worrying about financial based layoffs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it used to be that was the last resort. And now it feels like it's the first option. And that's what's disturbing. That's what bothers me.
Mm-hmm. The part that I don't get is, isn't this sort of crunch time in the last year where and they're putting everything into this game. They're doing testing. They're like, now's when they need the most people, you would think. And so as we look back on this, if there are issues with the game or it didn't take off and have the fit and finish that Chris was talking about that we've come to expect, is this going to be something that we'll be able to point back to? And you know, maybe there's some ramifications. I don't know. The timing doesn't make sense for where they are in development.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point you see game developers just in general get together and start to unionize because for them to keep being, I wouldn't say abused, but it just seems like common practice that, you know, layoffs, they just keep happening. So I wouldn't be surprised if they start to unionize. I get it. Like, yeah, game development, you know, the industry, it's a meat grinder. When you're done with the game, when a publisher is done with the game, they're moving on to another, you know, a different game, you know, they might look for different talent, stuff like that. Like, I get it. It's probably a project by project basis, but still, I mean, if that's the case, then they should probably try to unionize.
Yeah. Brandon, you've been involved in a lot of development projects, right? From your technical role.
Yeah.
Is the culture of game development similar to other kind of development areas? Like if you were just in an IT department or if you were in a group that was developing something that wasn't a game, is it the same? Because you've heard stories of that whole game culture development where it's, you know, 70-hour weeks and you're drinking Mountain Dew and Red Bull and all that other stuff to stay awake. Is it like groups?
So gaming is so interesting as far as a development culture. From a management perspective, it feels a little bit more predatory, mainly because people want to be there. You have testers who can go over to their friends because they got an early cut of Zelda, and that, you know, around the neighborhood, around the internet, gives them, you know, esteem and status.
Yeah.
So you have this large swath of people that are semi-technical or are technical who are doing the things that they love and they're working for their pastime. And so financially, it's not usually the most rewarding, but you get those other sort of less tangible benefits. I think there's some of the hardest working people in software development when people have come out of gaming to come work for me or come to, you know, more traditional software development. They are willing and ready to put in those hours. And when they find some of that work-life balance, like their motor doesn't stop turning. You just get a lot out of those folks. And I think they bring a creativity that you don't see in the financial side or, you know, automotive, because they're used to looking at things not only visually, but debugging into the code. thinking big world and through a lot of different scenarios. So I'm a big fan of that industry. I think from a quality assurance, like their testers are some of the best that I've had the privilege to work with. And but it is very different than fintech or, you know, other SaaS things as far as how the development goes.
Right. I also think that might be a nature of any job that you get. If you're a young person in the field, you go in with an assumption of I'm going to work long hours for low pay just because that's how I'm going to get ahead. And maybe that, because it was like that for me in the journalism industry. My first job, you know, as working at a newspaper, I was working 50 to 60 hours a week for no money, but getting that experience and, you know, doing the grind and realizing like there's a lot of other better jobs out there. So when I landed at a job that told me, oh yeah, we're only working 9 to 5, you know, Monday through Friday, I was like, holy crap, that's great. I love that because I got married and I started having a family and that kind of stuff. I was like, yeah, that's an awesome proposition. You mean I don't have to work on a Sunday shift or I don't have to work at a holiday? And they were actually apologetic to me because they're like, yeah, on Thursdays we stay until 7 or 8. I'm like, I was working till midnight half the time at my other jobs. So do you get that relief from gamers when they come to work for you?
Oh yeah. Well, and I think, what does everybody's parents tell them, or, you know, is some sort of mentor when you start working? It's, you know, do something you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And with gamers, they're just going to go home and game anyway. Like, that's all that they want to do. And yeah. So it doesn't feel like work. I think that while they are relieved, what they miss out on is sort of that, some of that mission driven, the things that they really love. And, you know, they're going to go and try and test the newest software or the newest game. They're going to go out and buy it and be inundated with it. So they're going to still get that adrenaline and fulfill that need. It just doesn't come through work anymore.
Right, right. Okay. I want to switch gears to our second topic, which was AMD rolled out its latest chips for AI PCs as competition with NVIDIA and Intel heats up. U.S. chip design firm Advanced Micro Devices has unveiled new processors to power AI-enabled PCs as it seeks to gain leadership in the AI PC race against rivals like NVIDIA and Intel. Basically, an AI PC is a personal computer equipped with processors designed to perform AI tasks, such as real-time language translation and summarization. So AMD made a pretty big splash. Again, it's still a three company race. Is that fair to say? Yes. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Yes.
I just want to make sure I'm not missing a fourth company. The question that I have around this idea of AI PCs, it's really, I'm just using this news as a launch pad, is do you think people from the consumer side or even a business user is going to want AI PCs? It feels like the news is like, all right, chip makers, hey, we've got these chips and put them in your PCs. And the PC makers are like, great, we need something new to really try to get sales going. And so they put these AI PC chips into their PCs. And then I think the next step is like, you should want one of these and this is going to be great. But to be honest, I haven't seen that marketing message yet on why I need to buy another PC that has AI chips on it. Because it's not like you can't, like I can use this current PC I have and do all of those AI things, like go to OpenAI and you know, Anthropic and all those other sites to build my wacky picture or ChatGPT. So I don't think they've made the case yet of like why I'm going to need an AI PC. Smarter, faster, better. It's like, yeah, we've heard that before. Or is it just the fact that I'm a Mac guy and maybe I'll just wait for Tim Cook to get up on stage and go like, we've got AI now. Ha ha. Buy this system.
I mean, you're probably 100% right with Apple. Apple's going to come out with it.
Yep, and then I'm going to get even gaga about it.
They invented AI, and it's going to be the best AI application we've ever seen, and it's going to be the future.
Yep.
And, Oh, oops, your feed went, oh, there you go.
I'm back. Brandon, I'm not fishing for this, but am I right?
I don't see the need for consumers to have to have these chips at this point. I don't really get it outside of marketing. I don't know. I guess it's cool. One interesting thing that this made me think of, though, right? So if you have an entire consumer base that has these underutilized GPUs out there, is there going to become a race in order to push things down and, you know, process locally versus doing it in the cloud to minimize costs? And
right.
Are we just seeing, you know, from sort of the bit mining, you know, Bitcoin mining happening elsewhere? And is that going to usher this in? I don't know what else it could do. I don't see a use case right now.
Right. And it's the same thing that we saw in the phone world. So Samsung came out with, you know, their big Galaxy announcement, I think from January at CES was, oh, we've got AI chips on our new Galaxy. And again, I'm expecting Apple to put it on the new iPhone. It'd be crazy if they didn't. It would be news if they didn't. It'd be like, oh yeah, we're still looking at it. We're like, okay, really? Why? but the features, it's like great that you've got a chip on it, but then the features or the apps that they're promoting are, well, okay, so Brandon, I'm looking at you now and you've got a little wreath behind you. I was like, well, if I took a photo of you right now, I could erase that wreath. Or if someone's like, oh, I don't like what's on top of Keith's laptop here, I can erase this if I'm taking a photo of him. Things like that. It's the AI photo eraser. Or it's the, hey, you know, ChatGPT will be integrated so that you can now ask a question on your phone. I haven't seen a use case for me to jump out and go and buy a phone. So it's going to be the same issue with a PC, because it always used to be like, well, there would be an application I would need that, you know, if I was doing photo editing and video editing, that's why you needed a faster computer back in the day. Yes. If you were a gamer, you would always go to that, you know, you're like, I need a faster gamer so that I can play, you know, what was the game back then? You know, because Grand Theft Auto 5 or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there has not yet been a use case for an AI PC. And I think that could get a lot of hardware makers in trouble as they release these systems. Unless I'm missing something completely, and if you're in marketing and you know what the marketing message is going to be, just comment below, because I haven't seen any cool marketing messages yet from any of the hardware makers. Have you guys seen anything?
I mean, no. I haven't, no.
Okay. We'll figure it out. And then we'll talk about it once they actually start coming up with these marketing messages.
Exactly.
Okay. Because even at CES, I think some of the, you know, the hardware makers, their big announcements were, yeah, we're going to include the chips, but then they didn't say what people were going to be using them for. And even if it was a lot of processing that needed to be done locally, those are still highly specific, probably job roles, like data scientist, or if you're running an AI algorithm, you know.
Yeah.
And that's boring. Like, no one wants to hear about that kind of stuff. All right. I want to move on to the next story. This is actually, now you said you had a personal connection to this story. So Amazon sellers have been plagued by a surge in scam returns. Amazon built one of the world's most efficient delivery systems, yet people regularly ship junk back to sellers and claim they are returns, often with little to no penalty, according to merchants. Amazon has long believed in a system based on pleasing customers above all, including easy returns, but that ethos has hurt the merchants who make up most of its online sales. Return theft represents one sore point in what has become an often contentious relationship between Amazon and its independent sellers. Basically, sellers count on Amazon to recover money lost from scam returns, but they say the time and effort required to submit a retail theft claim is not often worth it because it can take weeks to be processed. And even if Amazon accepts it, the seller might not get the full amount back for what the item costs. Many times sellers just say they take the loss. So theft comes from both networks of thieves as well as individuals who knowingly scam retailers. The frauds can happen in several forms, such as returning used items or shoplifted items to counterfeit products. I didn't realize how big of a problem this was until kind of I read this article. So it's basically, I could order a pair of sneakers and then deliver the new sneakers. And then I could say, well, I didn't like them and I return them, but I don't return the new sneakers. And I just put a couple of old sneakers in. And then, you know, it becomes a return scam, right? That's how that works.
Yep. Or yes, you take in you... buy, you know, the official item on Amazon from the official seller, and then you buy one of the, you know, outside sellers or counterfeit item, and you take the one that you want and you return the counterfeit one in the primary seller's box and you send it back to them.
Oh, that's even a better scam. Sorry.
That's the one. So when I was reading this story, I reached out. My sister has a great business on Amazon where she's building up and trying to combat this. And she was telling me all kinds of horror stories of when this happens, how Amazon is not very helpful, and how much of the impetus to prove fraud and to do this actually falls on the sellers, and that there are tools that get taken away if you over report on other people. So it seems like a really big mess and needs some attention. I just don't know, because Amazon's so customer focused,
right?
It's going to be a priority or not.
Yeah, I find it interesting that there are, again, if there's a giant enough system that's taking in a lot of money, there are probably ways to scam the system, and they just won't find the time. Like, they're just like, well, it would take too much effort for us to try to track all these down. But in the meantime, it does hurt those independent sellers. Does your sister feel like she has to be on Amazon in order to kind of like survive the 100%. Business she's in? So it's not like she can go anywhere else, right?
Yeah. Well, so she's on Etsy since she's creating her own products.
Yeah.
She also has her own direct store that she tries to get sell through Google or sell direct. But 90%+ of her revenue takes and comes in through Amazon. So that's where she gets a lot of all of her sales from.
Right.
It's super lucrative. She can't turn them away. She'd love to, but she just wants the system to work better and be more fair. And it's like, who do you even talk to? Amazon's big and faceless. There isn't a liaison,
right?
Especially for like the makers, you know, and I think that's where she's really frustrated.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I would, if I became a maker of some sort, not that I have any of those skills. I don't know if I would use Amazon as a support. I mean, doesn't Etsy have this issue too?
They do.
Yeah. I know that with Etsy, I think returns are probably a problem as well.
The volume is just a lot smaller.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering if this might get integrated into the FTC lawsuit that they're going after Amazon for, because I know that a big chunk of that lawsuit is about how Amazon treats its independent sellers. And yep. You can always tell, like, Amazon does the, you know, they ramp up the PR machine and go, look how great, you know, they find sellers on their site that are benefiting from the Amazon relationship. But at the same time, you've got other stories about how they're basically not helping those independent retailers or smaller ones. And so I think the answer is somewhere in the middle.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of lawsuits and things like that, there's another topic the Wall Street Journal reported that the Justice Department is preparing to sue Live Nation. Yay. As soon as next month, an antitrust challenge that could spur major changes at the biggest name in concert promotion and ticketing. And we can thank Taylor Swift for this. Because of this whole debacle of the ticketing last year, it spurred congressional hearings. That Senate hearing was highly entertaining, watching the Live Nation president squirm through a lot of the testimony. And it was one of those rare cases where you had Democrats and Republicans kind of agreeing, probably yeah. because their sons and daughters and grandkids were like, this is a mess. And anybody who's gone to a concert knows that Live Nation and Ticketmaster is a monopoly. Now, it's just a matter of how to prove that. Basically, the Journal reported that they're going to file an antitrust lawsuit against the Ticketmaster parent in the coming weeks that would allege the nation's biggest concert promoter has leveraged its dominance in a way that undermined competition for ticketing live events. And the federal government opted out of trying to block Live Nation and Ticketmaster's 2010 merger. So I think they're finally admitting, like, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have done this approval.
Yep.
And I know that from a technology standpoint, when this whole issue came up, it was all about the bots. But we've all learned from this. I think I learned it from the whole PS5 rollout from Sony, mm-hmm. About scalper bots and how they were able to get products faster than any normal human. The same thing happens in ticketing. Ticketmaster allegedly has this issue, you know, this program, but the more you dig deep into it, when Ticketmaster benefits from a resale, they get a cut of it, and it's like, well, so they're not really going to look at the whole scalper bot issue if they're making some money on resales and things like that. But I'm just happy. Sometimes there's good news in the world when you're talking about some government things, and maybe this will lead to some better options for customers that are going to an event or a concert. So
it's about time.
Yeah. All right. Anything else to add on that? You're a big Taylor Swift fan though, Chris, right?
Absolutely not.
See, the only problem with this story is that once they do sue them, you're going to have news articles and headlines that are all going to try to use Taylor Swift lyrics. Or that's the one thing I hate about this story is that they all try to prove how by putting in Taylor Swift lyrics or song titles.
Taylor Swift will come out and try to save Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
why don't we just let her be in charge of it? Because apparently everybody loves Taylor Swift so much, and you know, including two of my daughters.
I'm sorry, yeah. But T Swift music, it just all sounds the same to me.
I know it does to me as well.
I'm not saying she's a bad singer. She's not a bad artist,
and she's a great business mind for doing what she's doing. Like the whole Taylor's version where she's re-recorded all of her songs because of do you know this story? I don't. Again, I've got two teenage daughters, so I hear about this all the time.
It's fine.
My entire vacation was nothing but Taylor Swift in an RV for 7 days. So, I got my finger on that pulse.
Yeah. Like I don't want to listen to a song about, you're breaking up with your boyfriend or whatever. It's like, come on. That's so high school.
Yeah. And then the fact that it creeped into the NFL season last year kind of irks me a little bit, too. But I'm happy for you know, if Taylor Swift has found her true man, like good for her. But
she found her boo.
All right, this episode is just going off the rails. So let's finish with the real reason I wanted to talk to you guys this week was Fallout. The Fallout TV series has like exploded. I'm a big fan. I played Fallout 3, Fallout 4. I've dabbled in a couple of the other games. I love the lore. I love the series. I love the game. So I was very excited when Amazon said, we're going to make a TV show out of it. And so I've been following this stuff, you know, for a long time. And so I was like, I got to look for a story that I could talk about this on the show. And thankfully there was. So Fallout has more than doubled its concurrent players on Steam following the release of Amazon Prime's blockbuster TV show. Despite approaching almost a decade old, Fallout 4 is currently sitting in Steam's top 20 games by concurrent numbers, making it one of the most popular games on Steam this past weekend. But it's not just Fallout 4 that's seen a resurgence in players. Fallout 76, Fallout New Vegas have seen similar number increase in the player base since the TV series debuted on April 11th, I believe, was when they did it. And I'm just like everybody else. It's, you know, I finished the series and the first thing I thought of, and I was even telling this to my son, we were watching the show together. I said, he goes, this makes you want to play Fallout again, doesn't it, Dad? I go, yes, absolutely. I want to go back in. The problem I've had is that I re-downloaded Fallout 4 and there's a glitch with my DLC, so I can't play with the DLC. But then I heard that they're going to be doing a next-gen update anyway for PS5 owners. So and everybody on April 25th. So I'm just going to wait for that.
I think what it is because the show was done so well, it reminds you how good the source material was.
Yeah.
So it makes you want to go back and experience it again. And I myself also went back. I have Fallout 4.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, for a game that was made about 10 years ago, it's really good.
Yeah.
It's incredibly good.
It still holds up, right?
Holds up to 2024. And I mean, there's really nothing much else to say about it. I mean, I was surprised how good the show was. That's for sure.
Yeah. And you know, you and I have talked before, Chris, about video game adaptations. And there's a lot of disappointment sometimes where they try to make a Hollywoodized version of something and they don't get what the you know, essence or the vibe of the game is. Mm-hmm. But after that first episode, I was like, wow, they nailed it. Like they got the vibe right. It's not like you didn't get like a dark Fallout. You didn't get like a moody type of post-apocalyptic world. It's a world that's funny as hell when you're, you know, a lot of the little anecdotes they have during the series is like that I could see this happening exactly in the game. This is a side quest, for example, when you know, they show something and they make but they also don't do a lot of fan service. I think this is what the Star Wars and Marvel universe problems they've had is they try too much to do the fan service thing. I like when they do fan service and it's subtle, but it's still entertaining for someone who's never played the game. And Brandon, like, what's your level of Fallout enthusiasm?
So I got swept up in the hype. It's, I've noticed that it was coming out. Yeah. I started to see some reviews. I got to watch the first episode last night and just totally blown away. No pun intended, but it was just amazing, the world building. I never played the games, but they were always around and yeah. you know, seeing clips and those things. But to me, like, how far have we come since Super Mario Brothers 1993?
Oh man,
that movie with King Koopa, right? Yep. And like, to see where we are now, not only the new Super Mario Brothers movie was amazing.
Oh, no. Come on, no. Brandon. No, it was awful.
Oh, it was for me.
Well,
it was
just so for me. I know.
Keith, I can do you one better.
Okay.
I can do you one better.
All right.
The Halo series.
I haven't watched that yet.
I don't want to.
Oh, so you're That's saying how, the Halo series is not good.
Oh, no. Okay. I mean, any Halo fan would say, don't take your helmet off. And what do they do with the first episode?
Episodes ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. He takes his friggin' helmet right. off. Like, anyways.
Brandon, just really quickly, and I know you're a little bit younger than me, so I know you've got the nostalgia for Super Mario more than I do.
Yes.
I just think that if you rewatch the Super Mario movie, the dialogue is so bad, and the characters are, like, I think if you rewatch it with that knowing, like, this is really bad voice acting, and the voice acting was bad, and the dialogue was awful. Oh, did we lose you?
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
I think he froze.
I was sitting there, and Mario... Oh, am I frozen?
Yeah,
you're back. There you go. You're coming back.
Check.
There we go.
I'm back.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. I was just sitting there, and I was watching Mario taking train, and he was grabbing little mushrooms and jumping, and Peach was teaching him how to do it. I'm like, this, I was sitting there like in 1985,
right,
with the controller in my hand, feeling all of those things when I, you know, crushed my first Koopa and all those. Like, it was awesome.
Right, but that feels more like fan service than actual development of a plot or characters.
100%.
Okay. So, given that, I think, you know, the fact that you can still do fan service, but then also, you know, broaden it out to an audience makes Fallout at least exciting for me.
Yeah, they've done it very smart and tactfully.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just in your face, but to exactly what you're saying.
So one other question I wanted to ask you guys, too, was there was some criticism about Amazon releasing all 8 episodes at once. So it was the binge model, which I think Netflix made popular. Most of the Netflix shows, once they started, like Stranger Things, all released all at the same time, at least the first couple of seasons. But then you started seeing companies releasing their shows in a more episodic format. So you might get the first 2 episodes, but then you'd have to wait a week. Now I'm in that generation where I remember that's what you had to do when you watched a regular TV show. You would watch it and then you would wait a week. And I'm always amazed when I tell my kids about this. It's like, you know, I showed them an episode of oh God, this is going to really age me, but Happy Days or something with a cliffhanger. And the cliffhanger was like at the end of an episode, at the end of an episode, and you said, well, now we have to wait a week. Like the old Batman series. They were trapped in, you know, they were about to fall in the blowing pit. But then even worse was the season finale, and you had a cliffhanger, and then you had to wait 4 or 5 months. And so the kids just look at me, they're like, that just, you know, I'm sorry, Dad, stop telling us these horrible stories of your childhood.
Yeah, I think it's just a reflection of how today's media is sold, right? Because, like, if you think about it, really, like, back in the day when we didn't have streaming services, right? In order to see a movie or a TV show, you had to wait, right?
Yeah.
You had to wait till it's in theater. And then if you wanted to buy it on DVD, you had to wait till it comes out on DVD and stuff like that. But now with streaming, it's totally different. The business model is so entirely different because now it's a business of audience retention.
Yep. Keeping
your,
the subscribers. Yeah. And
exactly. How do you keep your viewers subscribed to your streaming service? And so... I think that's why you're seeing a lot of streaming services now, like, holding back their episodes, like, just do one a week, because now, it retains that audience longer so that you don't have to produce more content more frequently.
Yeah.
Right. So
why do you think Amazon then released all of them all at once instead of doing that model?
I mean, it's just their choice. It's just what they decided to do. I mean, I think, I think you might get people who will want to watch the series a second time around.
Yeah.
And maybe that wasn't their goal, right? Because Amazon is more than just a streaming service.
They right? are?
Yeah. I mean, we all know that. Yeah. But like if you're Hulu or Netflix, right, that's all,
that's
you, do.
All you do.
That's
right.
all you do. So,
right.
you know, you got to make your decisions accordingly. But with Amazon, they're probably like, we can afford it. Just dump it. Dump it all at once. You know, people will binge it in a day or two and that's
so,
it.
Yeah, I'm kind of in between the two spectrums where if you do release episodically, I yeah. will wait until there's at least 3 or 4 episodes that I can watch so that I, you know, or I wait until the entire series is out and then I'll binge it again or I'll, you know, but when I say binge, you know, it doesn't mean I'm watching all 8 episodes at once. It's like I'll watch 2 a night until I'm caught up.
Yeah.
And that's more of a lifestyle choice because of all the other things I have with the kids and the family and work and things like that. So it's somewhere in between that, you know, if I know that it's an episodic release, I'll wait until there's multiple episodes. Because if it's good enough, then I'll want to watch that next episode if I have the time. But I'm not opposed to having that whole, all of them released all at once. Cause then I know that I'll get to the end.
Oh yeah. I'm not opposed either. And especially if it's good.
Yeah.
You can continue it.
So I it was weird to see that outrage.
I wish that Amazon would make up their mind because I love Invincible, right? I read all the comics. Okay. I waited for season 1 forever from Robert Kirkman. It came out. It took forever. Season 2 came out. They gave us 4 episodes and they stopped for 3 months. And then now, you know, they just finished up with 2 more.
They did a mid-season. They did a mid-season break.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they did. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's weird that enough people have noticed that this episodic release, well, it not only does it feel like more traditional broadcast TV,
yeah.
Then they've all added advertising now. So again, we're all going back to that world, you know, from a financial standpoint of like they can't just rely on the subscriber base. They have to now add ads, or they have to then, you know, add those, you know, that money revenue generation.
And Amazon only did that back in January, right? That they added ads back into their content. And so this is one of the first or second big releases that they have. So maybe that's part of the testing.
Yeah. And then even I think when I was watching an episode, they just, before you start watching it, they give you 2 ads and they're like, this, you know, this is now presented ad free with this ad. Like it's one of those like presented by Samsung or Walmart or whoever, like they put the ad in the beginning, but then they won't bother you for the rest of the show. Whereas other ones will be like every 10 minutes, there's another ad, which feels like you're watching regular TV. That whole thing about churn, I think is really interesting. Cause I'm now, I think a few months ago we were talking about streaming services, Chris, where we were like, I'm going to be the type of person that's going to be adding and dropping. Remember we were talking about, I was going to cancel and then I'll just wait until the next thing comes around. And I think that's because like, I'm going to become more proactive if I'm not using a service.
Yeah.
And then just wait. So
you might see streaming services try to combat this.
Yeah.
We see it in other services.
I don't know if they're gonna actually. Yeah, I haven't seen anything yet where they're doing that.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they do, but you know how they'll have like, oh, you pay this amount per month, but you have to pay it annually.
Right.
They might.
I see that with some other subscription services. They give you a discount if you pay a year in advance versus just a monthly service fee. The reason I say that is that so I'm doing less and less of that. I'm actually saying to myself, well, there's still enough good content where I'm not going to immediately contact. So, for example, Peacock is my current issue. Like I was holding on to Peacock, and I'm planning on holding it because they're making the Community movie. Mm-hmm. So remember that TV show? And April 1st, they actually got the rights to it. So it went from Netflix over to Peacock. That's funny. And Peacock.
I hate April Fool's jokes, but this one was real.
Yeah. And then they put the band episode. So they had, you know, Netflix decided to there was the episode where they play D&D. And because one of the characters was playing a drow and they're dark elves, it looked like he was doing blackface. And so they, you know, Sony and Netflix, they kind of overreacted because even in that episode, it was within the context of the game that he was wearing, you know, he looked like a dark elf, not, it wasn't an African-American, blackface issue. It was more just that he was just role playing the game. He was cosplaying. Mm-hmm. And you know, once you saw that episode and knew that, then you know, there was enough outrage from people that were in the cast that said, no, they shouldn't have done that. Like, so that when it moved over to Peacock, they put that episode back in. So
got it.
That was exciting for at least fans of the show anyway, but I'm now finding myself, I'm not going to cancel and resubscribe until the price goes up. And then of course I'm immediately back off that bandwagon. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Thanks, Brandon. Good to see you.
Good to see you all as well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I think you are done with your stint, and we are going to, you know, we'll use you at some other points. We'll welcome you back, and I'm sure we'll have you back for another stint because you've been a fantastic commenter and guest host. So thank you again for doing this.
I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Take care. And that's all the time we have for today's episode. Don't forget to like the video, subscribe to the channel, add any comments you have below. Join us every week for new episodes of Today in Tech. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time.